I don't suppose many of you have heard of Pierre Hadot. Anybody heard of him? Put your hands up. Okay, not many of you. So Pierre Hadot was a great scholar. He died a few years ago. Great scholar of the ancient Western philosophic tradition, going right back to the Greeks and the Romans. And I was very, very impressed and influenced and inspired by a book he wrote. I must have read it over 10 years ago, called Philosophy as a Way of Life. And in that book, he made this very important distinction, I think, between philosophy as discourse, what he called philosophy as discourse, meaning the ideas of philosophy, the words, the teachings. Philosophy as discourse and philosophy as a way of life. Very important distinction, because according to him, the ancient Greek philosophers and the philosophies were actually spiritual traditions. They weren't philosophies in the modern sense of the term. You know, philosophy nowadays, have you ever tried to read a contemporary philosophical, book? They're really hard work, aren't they? Very intellectual. Well, the ancient Greek philosophies, according to Hadot, weren't really like that. They consisted of the words, the ideas, but also, importantly, a way of life. And if you wanted to really understand the ideas, you had to change your way of life. You had to do certain practices. He thought they were spiritual traditions with their own spiritual exercises. So it's a book well worth reading, Philosophy as a Way of Life by Pierre Hadot. And I mention this because in Buddhism you get a very similar idea. You've got the Buddha's teachings, which are words, which are ideas, ways of looking at things. And then you've got the Buddhist practices, ethical practice, meditation, and so on, study, which are ways by which we understand the Buddha's ideas. So, in fact, going a bit further, the Buddhist discourse is called the Dhamma. That's a Sanskrit word, Dhamma. And the practice is called Dhamma Vinaya. So you've got those two ideas in Buddhism. But going a bit further, Dhamma is one of those words that you get in the Sanskrit language, which have all sorts of depths and facets to them. And Dhamma means the teachings, but it also means truth or reality. Sometimes people translate it as nature. Less abstractly, you could say that the Dhamma is the way things are. The Dhamma is the way things are. So now we've got three levels here. You've got the truth or reality, the way things are. And then you've got the Buddha's teachings about that, what he says about the way things are. And then you've got the practices which help us to see things the way they are. Strictly speaking, according to Buddhism, reality or the truth, the way things are, is beyond the power of words to describe. Words are not adequate to the way things are. We can't really describe the way things are. And the Buddha's teachings are kind of more like pointers to the way things are. There's a Zen simile, is it? Is it a simile? You tell me in a moment what it is. Of a finger pointing to the moon. Yeah. Now, if I were to point over there, where would you look? Or if I point over there? You'd look over there or there, wouldn't you? I'd say, oh, look at that. You wouldn't look at my finger, would you, if I went like that? Well, some of you might. Did anybody look at my finger when I did that? So the idea is that the teachings are meant to point to the way things are. And sometimes we get a little bit hung up on the teachings. We look at the finger rather than the moon. The moon being reality in this. Is that a simile? Metaphor. It's a metaphor. That's what it is, yeah. So, the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings are a finger, or a number of fingers, pointing to the moon. So, where am I in my notes? Oh yes, so this evening I'm going to be talking about the Buddha's two great gifts to the world. Not my title actually. Originally I wanted it to be called The Buddha's Contributions, Two Contributions to the World, but Viri Bodhi thought that didn't sound very good in English. Would you agree with that? The Buddha's Two Contributions to the World? Doesn't sound as good as The Buddha's Two Great Gifts? Anyway, that's what we ended up with between us. The Buddha's Two Great Gifts. So, what are they? I'll tell you immediately what they are. Somebody who wanted to publicise this talk, another person who's not here this evening, wrote an email to me maybe 2 weeks ago, I think it was, saying, can you say a few words about what you're going to speak about for the publicity? And I didn't want to, because I wanted to be kept a secret. I didn't want people to know what these two great gifts were until you actually came. So I managed to write this little blurb, which didn't really say anything. So now, this is it. This is the two great things. The first one is dependent co-arising or conditioned co-production. Still doesn't mean anything at all to you, does it? So I'll have to explain to you in a minute what that is. And the second thing is the primacy of mind. So those are the two great things. And what I was thinking about these two great contributions were that I don't think these two ideas are just really good for Buddhists. I actually think the Buddhists left a legacy for the whole world here. In much the same way as some of the great philosophers, the Western philosophers, have had an effect on our society. I think that in the long term, these two big ideas of the Buddhas will have, and probably are having now, a big effect. They've got this potential to really have a big effect on the happiness of human beings, humanity. So they're important, I think. So I'm going to start with this first one, very technical, isn't it? Conditioned co-production, or dependent origination, or dependent co-origination, dependent arising. It doesn't really matter what you call it, so I'll tell you what it is. And I'm going to quote the Buddha here from an ancient Pali text. Very, very simple thing he said, which gives you an idea what it is. So here's the Buddha. This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. That's the first big thing. I'll just say it again. This being, that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. So the idea is that everything that comes into existence in dependence upon certain conditions. Nothing exists alone. Nothing exists independently of the world around it. That's the big insight that the Buddha had. Now, you might think this being, that becomes, it's kind of cause and effect, which is a Western philosophical idea. You get causes and effects. But it's not as simple as that. It's not a simple that causes that. It's multi-layered, multi-levelled. So let's use a concrete example. So this talk this evening, right? This is an event, yeah? Let's think about some, at least, of the conditions that brought this event about. We can't do them all. We'd be here all night talking about all of them. We'll just take a few choice examples of the conditions that brought this event into being. So, firstly, I was visiting Stockholm anyway, because I come here most years. So I come around May time, which is a good time to come to Stockholm, May. So I was coming anyway. And Viri Bodhi, the chair of the Stockholm Buddhist Centre, had this idea of me giving a public talk. So that's two conditions, isn't it? Me coming anyway, and as I'm here, why don't you give a public talk? And perhaps, I don't know why, I mean, I've been here many times, and he doesn't always ask to give a public talk, but I did a couple of years ago, gave a public talk. part of a series of public talks called The Big Questions that the Stockholm Buddhist Centre were putting on. So maybe that was in his mind. So that was another condition. And that idea of a series of public talks on the big questions, Viribodhi got from the Manchester Buddhist Centre, where I come from, because we did that a couple of years ago. So that's another condition, I think, for the arising of this event here this evening. He's nodding, so... He asked me, and I said yes. So that's another condition. What happened then? No doubt, I don't really know what happened on this side, but I imagine what happened is he had to talk to the council who runs the Buddhist Centre about it. He got this idea, what do you say, is that a good idea or not? And they must have had a discussion about it. I hope I'm not boring you, because this bit goes on a little bit of a long time to kind of make a point, so I'll... if you get bored, put your hands up and we can move on. They must have agreed to it. Next thing, he wrote me an email for a title. I'm a lazy person. I don't like writing talks because they're hard work writing talks. So I just decided to give a talk I gave last year at a conference in a university. So I just said, oh, I'll give a talk on the two great contributions to society. So this is a recycled talk with a little bit more in it than it was in that talk there. Viribodhi didn't think that sounded very good in Swedish, so we talked a bit around that. And I agreed to the new title. Next, can you imagine what happened next? They had to find a venue, and they come up with a date. So we had to do a bit of to-ing and fro-ing about the dates, and they found a venue, and so on. And then they had to advertise it. Yeah. So how many people, how did you find out about this talk? Was it through a poster? Put your hands up if it was a poster. One person because of the poster. So what else was it? A leaflet? Put your hand up with a leaflet? No. Word of mouth? Word of mouth. Ah, word of mouth. There we are. So words got round. So that's the next thing that happened. If you hadn't heard, if they hadn't spoken about it, you wouldn't be here. If you, the one solitary person, hadn't seen that poster, you probably wouldn't be here either. You getting the idea? Lots and lots of different conditions bringing this one event together. What else is there? You had to come. Yeah. If you weren't here, I probably wouldn't give this talk. Yeah. Just me and Viribodhi sitting here at the front. Probably wouldn't do it. So for me to be giving this talk, you actually had to come. And then for you to come, you had to have an evening free, or if it wasn't free, you had to talk to someone, maybe free yourself from another engagement, you know, have some kind of cooperation about you having an evening here. Did that happen for some of you? You had to talk to your... Can I please? Yep, so that had to happen. So this is all kind of quite recent stuff that bringing this talk here, isn't it? But going a bit further back, I had to be a Buddhist, didn't I, to be able to give this talk? So now we go back to 40 years, when I first came across Buddhism myself and went along to a Buddhist centre and learned how to meditate and so on. So all that way back, 40 years. Going further back, I had to exist in the first place. I had to be born. So now we go back to my mum and dad. Yeah, mum and dad who met each other, 60-odd years ago, and fell in love and decided to have a family, got together, and I won't go into the details, but they had me. So all that had to happen. So my mum and dad had to meet before the last war and get together and have me 60 years ago for this talk to be happening here this evening. Now, it starts getting very interesting now, doesn't it? Same with all of you. You know, you had to be born, didn't you, to be here. So we go back to all your mums and dads. We can go back further, can't we? They had to be born too. Mums and dads had to be born. So all our grandparents. All our grandparents are somehow implicated in this talk, going way, way back to their great, great, great grandparents and so on, so on. And then there had to be Buddhism. There had to be a Buddhism to talk about. So now we go back 2,500 years ago to ancient India. The Buddha had to be the Buddha, and he had to have given these two great gifts 2,500 years ago for me to be talking about them now. He had a mum and dad. If he hadn't had a mum and dad, he wouldn't have been born either. So we go way back. So it does your head in, doesn't it? thinking about all the different conditions bringing about this one event here this evening. Sure, you've had enough of that now. So let's go back to that little phrase, that little saying of the Buddha. This being, all that stuff I just spoke about for the last 5 minutes. Where am I in my notes? This being, that becomes, this talk happens. Yeah, all those events coming together here for this talk now. From the arising of all these things, this arises. And if any of the above that I mentioned hadn't existed, probably this talk wouldn't be happening. What if I'd said, no, I don't want to give a public talk? Well, we wouldn't be here. Yeah. What if the advertising went wrong? Well, it would be here, actually, wouldn't it? Because only one person saw the poster, so that would be here. We would still be here. But one person, who was the one person? Okay. You wouldn't be here. Yeah. So this wouldn't be happening for you. What if this Stockholm Buddhist Centre Council had thought, nah, bad idea, we don't want Managuna giving a public talk, this wouldn't be happening, and so on and so on and so on. Or maybe you weren't free this evening. Or maybe it's the football season, isn't it? Maybe there was a good football match on, but that happened on Monday, didn't it? So you were free this evening. Then, at around 8 o'clock this evening, this event comes to an end. From the ceasing of this, all those other events that I mentioned, that ceases. So this event will come to an end. That's the core of the Buddhist teaching, actually. It's the core of the Buddhist teaching. So, this is one of the two great gifts. Easy to understand, isn't it? Very simple. We need to be careful, though. The Buddha had a friend, a very close friend, cousin, actually. And they were very, very close. His name was Ananda. And Ananda became one of the Buddha's disciples. And one day, Ananda came up to the Buddha all excited. And I'm going to read you from a Buddhist text here. Ananda approached the Buddha. And having bowed down to him, sat down to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Buddha, "It's amazing, Lord. It's astonishing. How deep this dependent co-arising, what I've just been talking about, how deep this is, how deep its appearance, and yet it seems to me as clear can be." The Buddha said, "Don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. Deep is this dependent arising, and deep its appearance. And it's because of not understanding, not penetrating this Dhamma, this teaching, that this generation is like a tangled thread, a knotted ball of string, like matted rushes and reeds. And it causes, because of not understanding this, we suffer." So according to the Buddha, not understanding what I've just been talking about causes us to suffer, and understanding it brings us happiness. So I need to go into this a little bit further to see how that all connects. So this idea that I've just been talking about is quite easy to understand intellectually, but it's really hard to really perceive it. It's hard to live in the light of this teaching, the light of this truth. So let's go into it a bit more. So another thing the Buddha said about this is that events don't happen randomly. They didn't just happen. For instance, an apple seed doesn't grow into a melon. Yeah? And a chrysalis doesn't transform into a bird. Yeah? A chrysalis transforms into a butterfly. And an apple seed becomes an apple. Yeah? So it works in certain ways, doesn't it? Now, the Buddha didn't offer an explanation as to why things work that way. This is really interesting. He didn't say they work this way because of such and such. He just said, they just do. That's the way it works. So the Buddha wasn't a philosopher in the modern sense of the word. He didn't try to tell you why things work the way they do, how the world is like it is, and where we've come from, and so on. He didn't try to offer those kind of explanations. So, what this insight of the Buddha tells us is that the world we exist in, or you might say existence as a whole, is profoundly relational. It's relational. Everything depends on other things for its existence. Yeah? Everything that exists depends on things around it for its for their existence. So nothing exists independently. So the universe then is a network of conditions. Each thing, call it a thing for the time being, each thing or event being conditioned by a multiplicity of other events or things, and in turn conditioning other multiple other things and events. Do you get the idea? Everything is kind of connected and affecting everything else. We're kind of used to this idea with ecology, aren't we, these days? It's worth remembering we're talking about a man who lived in ancient India 2,500 years ago, saw this. Also, the world, existence, is processional. That's a word I coined. It's a bit of a funny word in English, processional. You think of processions. A procession is like a demonstration, a bunch of people walking down the street with placards, a procession. So what I mean by processional is things are processes rather than things. What we perceive as things aren't actually fixed things. They are processes. Everything is in process. Therefore, they're impermanent. They're changing all the time. Now, there's an ancient Greek philosopher called Heraclitus, and he's really famous for one thing only, I think. He did teach a lot of things, but there's not much left of his teaching. There are just a few fragments. He's most famous. Do you know what I'm going to say? Heraclitus? Who's heard of Heraclitus? Yeah. Yeah? The river. The river. Yeah. Okay. So what he said is, no man ever steps in the same river twice, for it's not the same river. Brilliant, isn't it? So there's a river flowing. Flowing. Yeah, it's flowing. And you step into it once, you come out, right? Now, when you step into it now, just a few seconds later, it's a different river because it's a different body of water going past. The water that you just stepped in is right down there now. Yeah, so now you step into a different river. That was Heraclitus. Brilliant. So you can never stand in the same river twice. A more modern philosopher, A.N. Whitehead, said, actually, you can't even step into the same river once. Yeah? Because as soon as you step into it, now the water's down there and you're still in there. So now it's a different river, different river, different river, different river. So that's how existence is, isn't it? It's different, it's different, it's different. Every moment it's different, different. And we kind of, it's too much for us, isn't it, to experience life that way. So we try to fix things and make them the same, same, same. But actually, they're different all the time. Even someone you know really well, when you meet up with them, they're a bit different than they were a little while ago. Because the second part of what Heraclitus said is not very well known, actually, but it's utterly brilliant. So, first part, no man ever steps in the same river twice because it's not the same river, and he's not the same man. That's the last part of it. The man who steps into the river is also different from moment to moment to moment. Yeah, different set of thoughts now, different emotions, yeah? Probably different cells in the body. Everything is moving. Everything is flowing, flowing onwards. And this leads me neatly to my second topic, the second of the Buddha's great gifts to the world, which is the primacy of mind. Yeah? Mind. Going to read you from the Buddha again. These are the first two verses of the Dhammapada. Dhammapada is probably the most famous Buddhist text. So, first two verses. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cart wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Did you get that? Did you get that cart wheel following the hoof of the ox business? The Buddha was very keen on using similes from around him. So you've got an ox pulling a cart, and just as the wheel of the cart follows the hoof of the ox, suffering follows if we act with an impure mind. Then he goes on to say the same thing, but opposite. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. Beautiful couple of verses, aren't they? Lovely. What did the Buddha mean by an impure mind? He meant a mind tainted by what are called the three poisons: greed, hate, and delusion, or confusion. A pure mind is free of greed, hate, and delusion, and is coloured, you could say, coloured by the opposite: contentment, generosity, friendliness, and awareness. So this is actually the basis of Buddhist ethics, this idea that the mind is chief, sometimes it's called. The mind is the basis of our experience. So I'm going to tell you a story now, don't need my notes for this one. Lovely, the best stories come from Zen Buddhism, all the best stories come from Zen Buddhism. So this is a story about an old Zen master. Have you seen pictures of Zen masters? Probably with a staff, you know, a stick, and probably a wispy beard, bald, wispy beard. And he's become very, very well known in his local district. People consider him to be enlightened. He's such a wise man, so kind, so compassionate. And people go to see him for advice. So, man goes to see this Zen master for advice. It's a nice day, it's a day like this. And they decide they're going to sit in the courtyard of the monastery. Small monastery. It's not like a massive thing. Just a few, you know, maybe 20 people living there. Little courtyard. They're sitting there. Probably the Zen master is like this with his staff here like that. And they're talking about the Dhamma. Anyway, they're talking away. And a deer just pops its nose around the corner of the monastery into the courtyard, looks around. We had a deer in the garden yesterday, didn't we, where we were living? Very, very, can't think, but they jump at the least thing, don't we? So anyway, this deer's sort of looking around, and the Zen master and this man are just quietly talking, so the deer thinks it's safe, and it comes in a bit more, comes in a bit further. The Zen master catches sight of the deer out of the corner of his eye. He grabs his staff, and he chases after the deer. Get out of here! Shouting at the top of his voice. Get out of here! Get out of here! Go! Go! And the deer just goes off like this. He comes back. Sits down. Puts his hands on the staff. And continues where we left off. Talking about the Dhamma. Man's a bit shaken up by this. He tries to carry on. But he says, I'm sorry. I just can't. What was going on there? You're supposed to be an enlightened Zen master. And you're chasing defenseless deer out of the place. What's the answer? What answer did the Zen master give to this man? Okay, I'll tell you. The answer is this. Animals really like to come here to this monastery because they feel how peaceful it is and how non-violent. They get to know that they can come here and it's safe for them. Because we don't eat meat. We never kill animals for meat. We're vegetarians. And they get this sense and they come. They come here. But you know what's going to happen? They're going to think that human beings are safe to be around. So they'll start nosing up to any old body. And what's going to happen next? You know what's going to happen next. Someone's going to kill that deer for meat, for food. That's what's going to happen next. So I'm just making sure that that deer knows that human beings are completely unsafe to be around. That's the answer. So, Buddhist ethics are what's called an ethics of intention. Intention, it's what you intend that makes, it's your mind, going back to the mind, a pure mind. If you have a pure mind with contentment and generosity and awareness and love, then what you do will be the expression of that mind. An impure mind, what you do will be the expression of that mind. So an ethics of intention. And there's a quote that I like to use quite a lot from Shakespeare. He has Hamlet say, "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." Brilliant. He must have said that in Elsinore, mustn't he? "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." So Buddhist ethics is based on what we call the law of karma. Everyone's heard of karma these days. The law of karma is this law that I talked about earlier, the first one, conditioned co-production, but in the realm of the mind. So actions, karma, proceeding from greed, hatred and delusion, result in suffering. Actions, karma, proceeding from the opposite of greed, hatred and delusion, result in happiness. For yourself and for the people around you. So now, I just want to say something about a common misunderstanding about the law of karma. And it's an important misunderstanding. It has effects. So the misunderstanding, or we might call it a fallacy, is that everything that happens to us is a result of our previous karma. Yeah? Have you heard this idea that everything that happens to you now, somebody's horrible to you, or you lose your job, or you get ill, and somebody says, "Oh, that's your karma. That's, you deserve it because of what you've done in the previous life." So the Buddha did not teach that. What the Buddha taught was things that you think, say, and do now have an effect in the future, definitely. But not everything that happens to us is a result of what we've thought, said, and done, is it, when you think about it? Yeah? Other people are involved. You know, there are some people who are just nasty to us for no reason. We haven't done anything at all. We don't deserve it at all. And then they sack us, or they say something nasty to us, and it hurts. But that's not us. We haven't brought that about ourselves. It's just what happens out there in the world. The tsunamis that we had a few years ago, that's nobody's fault. Nobody brought those about. They're just things that happen in the world. As long as we've got a body and we live in this world, things like that can happen, but it's not our fault. We haven't brought it about from our previous actions. So that's a really, really important distinction there. So, going back to the law of karma, do you remember? Greed, hatred and delusion brings unhappiness. The opposite brings happiness. So the Buddha talked about these as bright and dark. So there's bright karma, which leads to happiness, and dark karma, which leads to unhappiness. So, let's go back now to this idea of conditioned co-production being profoundly relational, to do with relations. So, that there are no things, you could say there are no things in this world, there are only relationships. And Buddhist ethics is based on this insight. You could say, being a little bit provocative here, that there are no people, there are only relationships. Yeah. Of course there are people, but I'm just making a point here, that the relationships are very, very important. And the relationships between us are not relationships with fixed things, they're relationships between processes. So there's a mutuality of processes going on. So the Buddhist project really is to understand this, not only intellectually, although this is a good start, but also perceptually. So you actually perceive the world in this way, you experience it in this way, and to try to live from that perception, to live from that insight. And we do this by following the path, what the Buddha called the path, leading from where we are now to enlightenment or awakening. Simplest formulation of that path, because there are different ways of looking at it, You may have heard of the Eightfold Path. That's a famous one, but that's a bit too complicated to go into now. I'm going to talk about the simplest one of all, which is the Threefold Path. Three elements to it. The whole of the spiritual life is enveloped in these three elements. First one is ethics. I've talked about ethics already, so I don't need to say very much about this. When we live ethically, we live as if we perceive the world in the way that I've just been speaking about, as profoundly relational. We live as if we really know that what we think, say and do actually affects other people around us. And we live in the light, or we try to live in the light of that insight. Second is meditation, or concentration, or absorption. I suppose most people know that Buddhists meditate. I suppose that's common knowledge these days. What is it, and why do we do it? We meditate to bring the mind to stillness, to reach a state of absorption, tranquility. And this stillness, absorption, tranquility prepares the mind to perceive the world as it really is. That's why we meditate. Another philosopher, more recent one, Gabriel Marcel, said, this is a lovely quote, "There can be no contemplation without a kind of inward regrouping of one's resources, or a kind of ingatheredness." To contemplate is to ingather oneself in the presence of whatever it is being contemplated. I love that. Ingatheredness. It's not a word. It's not a word, actually. It's not a proper English word. He was speaking in Aberdeen in 1946. He gave this lecture and he talked about this, and he just coined this word out of nowhere, which I think is a lovely word. I'm just going to read it to you again. "There can be no contemplation without a kind of inward regrouping of one's resources, or a kind of ingatheredness. To contemplate is to ingather oneself in the presence of whatever is being contemplated." So if you want to really understand something, you can't do it in a distracted way. You have to absorb yourself. You have to become concentrated, ingather all your energies into one place. And then you can really begin to understand. That's what meditation is. Leading to the third level, which is wisdom. And this is seeing things as they really are. Directly, perceptually, not conceptually, but direct perception of the way things are. Put in words, that means that we understand that things are conditioned, they are relational, they're processional, they're impermanent, without fixed, independent thingness. That's the threefold way. And then the Buddha also described what it was like to go through those stages. So a subjective, what it actually feels like to experience moving through the path to wisdom. So I'll just say a bit about that. First is dukkha. Dukkha is an ancient Pali term. And it means something like unsatisfactoriness. You know what that is, don't you? The feeling of, don't like this. Or this could be better. Or something missing here. Something missing in my life. Do you know that feeling? That's unsatisfactoriness. And the Buddhist path often begins with that sense of That's the best way I can put it, actually. That sense of things aren't quite as I want them to be. And then if you come across the Dharma or something like the Dharma, you begin to have faith. Now, faith, English word, it's got all sorts of connotations to it, unfortunate connotations, perhaps. The Pali word is saddha, which actually means to place the heart upon. So here, you begin to feel, maybe there is something else. maybe there's another way of being. That's what faith really is. You place your heart upon something else. Out of that, you begin to practice. And out of that practice begins a sense of joy. You begin to feel a bit happier, a bit up than you were before. So joy, leading to rapture or ecstasy, or maybe both. Rapturous ecstasy, ecstatic rapture. Brilliant. Sometimes this happens in meditation. I've talked about meditation earlier, and you probably think, what's that rapture got to do with meditation? What happens is, as you begin to ingather yourself, to use Gabriel Marcel's terms, if you begin to ingather yourself, certain energies are released. And with that release, you become moved. Isn't being moved an interesting experience? You know, when you're watching a movie at home, maybe, or at the cinema, and it gets to the climax, and the man and woman meet after all, and it's all okay. And you get moved, you know, you get this lump in the throat. Men get a lump in their throat, and they don't really do much else with it. And women tend to cry, and I envy that. I think, I wish I could cry about this. But, you know, that sense of being moved, or listening to a piece of music. How many of you really listen to music, rather than just have it on in the background? Really listen to music. And, yeah, fantastic, isn't it? And you know what it's like to be moved then, when you just... It just overflows, doesn't it? It's just like, whoa, you're in a different world. What is that? What is that being moved? I often think it's a part of ourself which feels kind of hemmed in, and it wants to break free. And it's almost like the real you is coming out when you move. It's like, whoa, this is really me. So, I have got a poem here. It's in quite small type, so I'm going to put my glasses on. It's a poem called From Blossoms. And because it's spring now, again, second spring, it's by someone called Lee Young Lee. From Blossoms. From Blossoms comes this brown paper bag of peaches. We bought from the boy at the bend in the road, where we turned towards signs painted peaches. From laden boughs, from hands, from sweet fellowship in the bins, comes nectar at the roadside. Succulent peaches we devour. Dusty skin and all, comes the familiar taste of summer. Dust we eat. Oh, to take what we love inside. To carry within us an orchard. To eat not only the skin, but the shade. Not only the sugar, but the days. To hold fruit in our hands, then bite into the round jubilance of peach. There are days we live as if death were nowhere in the background. From joy to joy to joy, from wing to wing, from blossom to blossom, to impossible blossom, to sweet impossible blossom. I had one of those moments there. I had to stop. Did you notice? I was moved. I was afraid if I spoke I would burst into tears. Those last two verses, I know it's in a language which is not your first, so it may be a bit difficult, so I'll just read the last two verses again. Oh, to take what we love inside, to carry within us an orchard, to eat not only the skin, but the shade, not only the sugar, but the days, to hold the fruit in our hands, adore it, then bite into the round jubilance of peach. Jubilance, not an English word, I don't think. Yeah, comes, I think he's sort of used a word like jubilation, this sense of uplift. Jubilance of peach. There are days we live as if death were nowhere in the background. From joy to joy to joy, from wing to wing, from blossom, to impossible blossom, to sweet impossible blossom. that sense, isn't it, of more and more, better and better and better. And you think, it can't get any better than this. But it can. It can. For a while. Because then, after the rapture comes calm. You can't go on like that forever, getting better and better and better. You'll blow out. So after a while, it all calms down. And that might seem like a bit of an anti-climax. It's like, oh, what a pity. But actually, by then, you've had enough. You know, it's like, that's quite enough, thank you. And you need to calm down. But now, the calmness you feel has been informed by that wonderful, blissful experience. And now you're much more fully present to yourself. So the calm is also a kind of wholeness, which leads to bliss. Now, bliss is different from joy in here because it's a quiet satisfaction, deep satisfaction of just being alive. And when you're in this state, you need nothing. You want nothing. There's absolutely nothing in the world which can be any better than the state you're in at the moment. Brilliant. Leading to absorption. So now, at last, we get to this absorption. Now you're fully here, fully absorbed in this moment. Nothing else is happening. Just this moment. Leading to insight. Knowing and seeing things as they really are. Leading to a serene withdrawal from all the things in the world that have caused you pain and unhappiness and unsatisfactoriness and, frankly, sometimes misery. Serene withdrawal from those things, leading to dispassion. Passion comes from the word suffering. So dispassion is a state of no suffering, leading to freedom, leading finally to awakening or realization, full enlightenment. When we see the world in this way, we are what is called wise. But we are also kind, loving, affectionate. Because what we've realised, what we've perceived, seen, is our connection, our connectedness with others. Not as an intellectual idea, but as a living reality. And compassionate, because we see that others are still living under the delusion, the deluded idea of a fixed and static self in a fixed and static world. And this, according to the Buddha, is suffering. The end. So, do we have time for questions? Yeah. Do you want questions and answers? Yeah? Or do you want to... Is that it for you? Oh, we got
Could
one there.
Just repeat the question for the mic.
Repeat the question for the mic, yeah. Okay, there's one at the back there, yeah? Okay, so... Okay, so the question is, do I think there are any Western philosophers that have come close to the Buddha's teachings? I'm not really qualified to say, actually. I've mentioned, I think, three Western philosophers, haven't I, in this. I haven't really read them in any great depth, so I'm not really a great expert in Western philosophy. So I think I'll probably say nothing about that and let you explore yourself. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yes, I was thinking about the physical death.
Yeah.
And do you think Sangharsita, for example, can't... when you talk about processes and gathering yourself, is there a kind of personal... continuation after the physical death.
Okay.
Of the processes.
Mm, okay. So, straight into a difficult area here. Thank you. So the question is, thinking about physical death, you know, real death, what happens? Is there some kind of continuation? So let's go back to the Buddhist, the Buddha's insight into conditionality, which is that there are no things, there are only processes. So in a sense, there is no continuation because there are just processes. But think back to when you were, say, 5 years old. Yeah, can you remember being 5 or 6 or 7? Do you remember your first memories? Go back to your first memories. You were a child, right? Do you remember being a child, whatever age? Are you the same person now as you were then? You're not really, are you? But are you completely and utterly different? Difficult one, isn't it? No? No? Difficult to say, isn't it? But there's a continuation, isn't there? There's definitely continuity between me as a 60-year-old and me as a 5-year-old. I remember my 5th birthday. That's my earliest memory. Remember that. And that was definitely me. Definitely me, I remember. But a very, very, very different me than this one here. So, biologists tell us that every 7 years, every cell in our body, is that still current? Is that still what people think? That every 7 years, we have a completely new body. All the cells have been renewed over a 7-year period. So, I'm 60. Oh, work it out. How many new bodies have I had in that time? Many, many. I don't know how many. So the body is completely different. So what about the mind? Well, what is the mind? The mind is what? Thoughts? Feelings? Is there any... There's continuity, but is it the same? So there's a candle flame here. If we had another candle... Yeah, there is, isn't there? They're all alight already, though, aren't they? Mm. Have you a candle that hasn't been lit yet? Mm. If not, I just ask you to imagine doing it. You can imagine lighting a candle, can't you? It's quite easy. I've got them going now, I can't stop. We'll have to wait for them. Yay, look at this. Okay. Thank you very much, team. Thank you. Okay, so, candle. Candle alight here. I've got wax all over my fingers now. So, I light that candle. Right. Flame. Is that flame? Is it the same flame? How many people think it's the same flame as that one there? Put your hands up. Same flame, okay. How many people think it's a different flame? Put your hands up. Right, that leaves a few of you. Who hasn't put your hands up yet? Put your hands up now, okay. What do you think then?
Neither
and both. Because it's not a thing, right? This is not a thing. It's a process of combustion. Process. Wax all over my fingers. Oh, I don't know what to do with it now. So do you get the idea? So now let's be a bit more serious. Take it to a human being. What are we? According to the Buddha, we're rather like candle flames. Yeah, we're not a thing. We're a process. We're not exactly a process of combustion, but we're a process. We're just processing through our lives. So what happens to that process when we die? It's hard to say, isn't it? We don't really know. God, wax all over. The Buddha reckoned that that process keeps on processing. It keeps on processing. There's not a person, a kind of fixed soul or self that carries on, but that process in some way continues. That's what, apparently, according to the Buddhist tradition, happens once we die. Do you get the idea? Yeah. Makes sense? Does it help us, really, to know that? most people it doesn't really help, because it's like, well, the Buddha was more concerned with what happens now.
But we need a goal, and if there's nothing after death, then what is
the goal? Oh, I see where you're coming from. Okay, so we need a goal, and if there's nothing after death, when you die, that's it. Okay, okay. So, I think... Yeah, yeah. So, the goal for Buddhists is to try to gain full enlightenment, just like the Buddha did, but it's a hard thing to do. And I'm 60, I've been at it for 40 years, just about nearly 40 years, and I'm a long, long way from enlightenment. So I'm thinking, probably not going to make it. I'm probably not going to get to full enlightenment. In fact, I'm definitely not going to gain enlightenment in this life. At the rate I'm going, something would really have to change drastically for me to gain enlightenment. So, having got that out of the way, what happens next? I know what the Buddhist tradition says. Buddhist tradition says, well, you just be reborn. That process which we call Ratnaguna will be reborn, and you'll just continue. Maybe that's what will happen. I don't really know. Yeah. Yeah.
Concerning this conditional issue, everything depends on everything else.
Yeah.
And that is a very big issue, a big thought. It's not only Buddhism, but perhaps it comes from Buddhism, as you mentioned. Okay. As it is so big, how does it help us when we live in our daily life? I mean, what does this insight that everything depends on everything else help us here? I read a lot of Buddhist literature, but I know really the standard questions, but I'm not satisfied with that. I want some more, as it is so big. And Buddha found this out. So could you add something to these sort of standard answers?
I'll try. What we need to do is chunk it down to actual experience, isn't it, now, here, because it's a big insight, but it matters. That's the important thing, it matters to us. And, I suppose you could start talking about ecology, couldn't you? Because ecology tells us the same thing, more or less, that everything that we do, and everything that we've done as a human race these past, how many years is it since the Industrial Revolution? Everything that we've done has been affecting the planet we're in, and we're in a critical juncture, aren't we? Critical. Some scientists think it's too late now, you know, we've ruined it, we've ruined the planet. Some scientists say, no, we've got to act now, because we can stop some of the ruination that's coming about. So that's a very simple example of how everything that we do affects everything else, yeah? But then that's still rather big. So let's come back to, you're at home, you're with your partner, and you're in a bit of a mood. And your partner's in a good mood, and you're not in a good mood. And not being in a good mood, your partner being in a good mood is getting on your nerves, yeah? That happens. Does that happen sometimes? Getting on, he or she is just too cheerful. What have they got to be cheerful about? Why are they so cheerful? And you then say something out of irritation, because that person's good mood is affecting you in a certain way. So you get irritable and you say something expressing that irritation, which hurts your partner. Yeah, that's that law. That's the law of conditioned co-production. Yeah. The process which we call your partner is affecting the process which we call you, and you react in some way, in a way which will hurt that person. I got on a bus a few weeks ago. You've all had this experience, I'm sure. You might be one of the perpetrators of this, but I got on a bus, and there's a young man with earphones in, and the music was really loud. Yeah? Have you been in that situation? Really loud. So I sat in front of him. It was really loud. So I just turned around and I just said, could you please turn the music down? Have you done that? You had to do that? Yeah. And he said, what? I said, could you turn the music down a bit? It's really loud. And he was really annoyed with me. Really annoyed. and he was Spanish, and he started really having a go. No, really having a go at me. And so I, okay, I just let him go. And he put his earphones back, and he didn't turn it down at all. Just so. Now I'm sitting on that bus with the music going on, and I'm feeling fed up. So there's two things going on. Yeah, two things. Eventually, I get off the bus. Now, there could have been another scenario, couldn't there? Let's imagine another scenario. I get on the bus, music's going on. I turn around to him and go, could you please, he says, well, he has a go at me. And I say, oh, where are you from? I am from Madrid. So, Spain's great, isn't it? I was in Madrid a few years ago. Heat wave, do you remember that year? Is it real heat wave in Madrid? So hot. And my daughter lives in Barcelona. Oh, Barcelona, yeah. Which football team? Yeah. And we get into a conversation. We have a really good time. Yeah. That's another scenario, isn't it? So the way we are actually affects others, and the way others are affects us. So that, does that help? Does that get a bit closer to how that conditioned co-production is actually effective in our lives?
I agree. I think everyone should agree to that. But I'm more looking for something that has to do with the notion of emptiness and what that means to us. For example, if you have problems and pain, this perhaps could tell you, this principle could tell you that that is not so. It is, it has to, depends on so many different things, so there is nothing in there really, or something. Mm-hmm. That's how I have interpreted it, or perhaps many others. In that case, I mean that you could sort of, well, as in this situation you mentioned, that the scenario is, what is this scenario? Is there anything in it, or is it just illusion?
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay, I understand a bit better where you're coming from now. Okay, good. So, according to Buddhism, because you are just process, there is no self. I think that's what you're getting. There's no fixed self. Because we have our experience, and then we interpret there's a self somewhere deep inside us. Would you say that's right? We assume there's some kind of self deep inside us. And the Buddha said, no, there isn't. There is just actions and thoughts and feelings, and there's no self having those actions and thoughts and feelings. Yeah? I think that's where you're getting us to. So what good is that to us? Where does that get us? Is that helpful? According to the Buddha, it's very, very helpful, because what that means is that when I get upset at someone, there's no real reason for it. There's no need to become upset. Yeah. So that young Spanish man on the bus, I was a bit upset. I felt, you know, that feeling of, oh, this isn't right, you know, I've got to listen to this horrible music. But there's no need for that. Didn't have to be like that. I just thought, oh, well, he likes to listen to music, and hey, there you go. And there's no problem. There didn't have to be a problem. But we tend to make problems for ourselves because of what we assume is a self at the centre of it all. And so, you know, when you get a bit, you know that feeling of outrage? You ever felt outraged? What is that? You know, how dare he? This lovely English phrase, how dare he? Do you have a similar phrase in Swedish? How dare he do that to me? How dare he say that? What is that? Where's that come from? It's because we really believe that there's this important self deep inside us that's been deeply offended. But actually, there isn't. So there's no need for offence. There's no need to get angry with people. You could say that anger and feeling outraged and upset and so on is just illusory, because it's just based on the illusory idea of a self deep inside us. Will that do?
Right. And I guess that Buddha said something just a thought, a sound, just a sound.
Yeah.
And also this a metaphor about the two arrows.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the same thing?
It is the same thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Suppose you want to know the metaphor of the two arrows now? So the two arrows is, according to the Buddha was said once, you know, when a wise man gets hit by an arrow, in those days, I suppose people got hit by arrows a bit more commonly than we do, gets hit by an arrow, it really, really hurts, right? No doubt about that, it really hurts. But a wise person doesn't get hit by a second arrow. An unwise person does get hit by the second arrow. Now, we're talking metaphorically here of arrows. The second arrow is your reaction to the first arrow. So, something happens, somebody says something unpleasant to you, and you feel it. Ooh, that hurt. And that's, for a wise person, that's the end of it. But for an unwise person, what do you do when that happens? When somebody says something unpleasant to you and you feel hurt by that, what do you do? How long do you think about that afterwards? How long does that go on? A few hours? Maybe overnight into the next day? Maybe a week? Maybe longer than that, depending? Yeah, it could go on for ages and ages. We relive it, don't we? We relive that event in our minds. We rehearse it, whereby we say something really cutting back. Do you do that? Rehearse, he said that, and I should have said this. Now I'm going to say it in my mind. Yes. And you do it a few times, and it makes you feel better. But it doesn't actually. It just keeps the whole thing going. So that's what's called the second arrow, which is our own stuff. So, living in as a human being in the world, we do suffer sometimes, but we bring about a lot of suffering upon ourselves. Yeah. 22:08. And it finishes at 8, and there's tea and biscuits. Is that a hand up? Oh, okay. Oh.
You wanted to finish?
Go on.
Yeah, let's finish.
No, go on.
No.
One more.
Okay. When you talked about the first gift, then you said, you quoted Buddha,
mm-hmm.
and you said, this sounds like cause and effect, but it's more than cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said some more things,
mm-hmm.
And I wonder, do you think, does it mean that it is something else than cause and effect, or are those other things, do they have all the base of cause and effect?
Okay, so two things to say to that. I'll come back over here to answer. Two things to say. First of all is Buddhism doesn't really talk about causes and effects. It talks about conditions for the arising of things. Because when something happens, we often assume that that thing there caused it. But we don't know for sure that that's the case. We don't know for sure that that caused that. All we know that whenever that happens, that seems to happen afterwards. So the Buddha didn't go on to say that that causes that. That's one thing. And the second thing is it's closer to the Buddha's teaching to say causes and effects, or conditions and effects, rather than in Western philosophy, you got the idea of the billiard ball, haven't you? You hit a billiard ball and that ball hits that one. So one cause, one effect. But in Buddhism, it's not like that. It's sort of multiple conditions which seem to, every time you get these multiple conditions, this happens. But we don't know for sure that this causes that. All we know is whenever you get this, this seems to happen. Sometimes it doesn't happen. Yeah. Sometimes you get all these conditions together and this doesn't happen in the end. Doesn't it? Sometimes that happens. But not always. You could see it like, I suppose I could draw on here, couldn't I? You've got a building, yep, door, windows. You need that building for the roof to arise, yeah? Without that building, you couldn't really have that, well, you couldn't, could you? You couldn't have the roof. But the building didn't cause the roof to arise, yeah? But independence upon the building arises a roof. Or maybe not. Maybe the builders ran out of money and they never did put a roof on. But you do need the building for that roof Do you see what I mean? Is that a bit closer?